Hey there, it's Ziva, and welcome to On Becoming, a podcast that sheds light on the untold transformation stories of women leaders, creators, and entrepreneurs. Those decisive but often overlooked moments that shaped who they are and point us towards who they're becoming. Listen to find out how their hidden journeys can help unlock your own potential. So my guest today is Lindsay Tremuda, a Philadelphia native who moved to Paris over 15 years ago. Lindsay and I met online back in 2009. I had recently launched my blog, Paris by Appointment Only, and Lindsay was sharing her fresh Paris observations and obsessions on her blog, Lost in Cheeseland. I had to say au revoir to my blog when I was recruited in 2010 to lead Yelp France, but Lindsay kept her finger on the pulse and grew year after year into one of the most respected and knowledgeable voices on contemporary Paris culture. Lindsay writes regularly for publications like the New York Times, Condé Nast Traveler, Fortune Magazine, and Vogue, and she's the best-selling author of two gorgeous and fascinating books on modern-day Paris. Her first title, The New Paris, explores the people and places redefining the Paris culinary scene. And her most recent release, The New Parisienne, is an empowering and educational book that pokes holes into the idealized, unrealistic image of La Parisienne, and instead recasts the Parisian woman as she truly is, in all of her complexity and diversity. Lindsay also has a fantastic podcast called The New Paris, where she covers everything from where you can get the best pizza in Paris to what to think about Emmanuel Macron's very bizarre behavior after France's World Cup defeat. Lindsay's name is synonymous with France, and for many aspiring culture and travel writers, she's the reference. But how did she get her start? What fears and insecurities did she have to overcome? Why did she leave home in the first place? And how did that decision transform her? And how is it continuing to shape the woman she's becoming? That's where our conversation begins. I hope you enjoy it. To give you a little bit of backstory about the concept of On Becoming. So for, I don't know, a long, long time, I think longer than I can possibly even identify, I've been kind of fascinated with how people become the versions of themselves that they become. And also in terms of my work, it's really relevant because we're trying to kind of explore in a little bit of a sociological, archaeological way, little glimmers of personality and interests and talent and genius that were maybe scattered throughout like little breadcrumbs along the path that you may not have noticed because we've been focusing on other things. And so I love that kind of detective work, kind of going back and sniffing around like a bloodhound to try to figure out what these crumbs are. So you have become synonymous with your adopted city. You're, you know, a well-respected and celebrated culture and travel journalist who reports for the best publications in the world and the author of best-selling books about Paris. But I want to go back to the backstory. And find out a little bit more about Lindsay, who grew up in Philadelphia, and how you became the version of yourself that we know and love today. So what I want to talk about is something that I see happen often when I am coaching women who are at a crossroads in their life and pondering a big life change. There's usually like two forces at play. They're either moving away from something that's not working out for them, or they're leaning towards a destination that they believe will help them grow. And those two forces can be mixed together in some kind of like, you know, strange melting pot. But I feel like with a certain amount of time under your belt, you may be able to detect which force was more dominant. So maybe you can let us know how long you've been living in Paris. And knowing what you know today about the path that you've been on, what do you think was really driving your decision to move to France?
Such a good question, because I still feel like the answer after 16 years, so that's the first part of the answer. It's been 16 years, so not quite as long as you, but, you know, inching my way up to becoming what I like to joke as is a lifer, although it's not a prison sentence. You know, I don't know for sure. I think there are multiple things going on. I think I left not because I thought it was going to get me somewhere, because I didn't know. I came when I was 20, about to turn 21. I was sort of like, is this a detour? Is this just a blip? Is it an experience that I will then take back to the US and then build a life there? And, you know, there was sort of no forethought or foresight into what this was actually going to do for me. So if I look back now, it does seem like I was, what were the two words you used? Is it like, you know, fleeing or flocking? Is that what it was?
Exactly. Were you more of a fleer or a flocker or a seeker or, you know, a self-exilist? What was going on?
Well, so I think it's maybe a combination of those terms, because I didn't know I was fleeing, but I'm sure there's an element of that. It's like, I want to go because maybe it will unlock something in myself and then I can change my circumstances. But this is something I'm passionate about. So of course I want to spend time in another country. That's so cool and potentially life altering in some way, even if you don't stay. But then I think it was, you know, if I really drill down, I think it's seeking. I was seeking who I was going to become and if France could play a role in that. And so, yeah, now that I'm saying it out loud, I think my word and what sort of defines my exit was seeking. And I would say that's sort of what I'm always doing is seeking a better understanding of myself, a better understanding of people, of places. And ultimately, you know, is there a bit of escapism involved in that or self-exile, as you said? Yeah, probably. But the dominant force was probably, who could I be if I'm not staying where everyone else stays? And if I'm taking this passion I had for language, which, as you know, is not super encouraged in the US to sort of pursue in any serious or professional way, you know, what is that going to do for me? And I didn't have many expectations. I actually had, I would say, probably negative expectations, you know, sort of, well, what could possibly happen? I'd need to go back to the US regardless. And I think what happens is when you do get to a different place, whether that's just a different state or a different country, you sort of, the realm of possibility opens up, and it might be fraught with obstacles and challenges, but suddenly other doors seem visible that weren't before. And so I think that's what I wanted. I wanted to see, like, okay, well, what if I stay longer? What if I keep opening other doors?
And so what do you remember? I mean, France was that the possibility, the door that seemed like an interesting one to open for you at that time of seeking and maybe fleeing. Was there anyone in your life who you felt embodied that path? Was it someone that you read about? Was it a version of yourself that you envisioned? What was the, you know, kind of like the carrot that was dangling in front of you that where you said, I think that's going to be me, or I'd like that to be me?
So interesting, because I had literally no personal examples of anybody who had really done this. Like my older sister had gone, there was a program in high school. I don't know if this existed where you were, but called People to People. And it was a program she joined to spend, I want to say maybe it was like, in my head, it was like a year, but I don't think it was. I think it was like a semester with a host family in another country. And she went to Germany. And I remember thinking, like, okay, that's something that people do. But I didn't have anyone in my circle or in my parents' circle who had moved, who had left the country. As it turns out, I have since met my cousin, an older cousin, who has become obtained Italian citizenship and has spent time in Italy and has sort of made that part of his life. But I only met him literally 3 weeks ago. This is sort of a family member, you know, reconnecting. So if I think about even, you know, in film or books, there was no one who really stood out to me as being a model to follow. The only person I can think of maybe who had an element of sort of the role as of a mentor for me was my French instructor in high school, because she was, you know how you can't really tell someone's age,
right,
when you're young. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea. She was probably super young, like probably mid-20s max. But I remember feeling that she was younger than all the other instructors we had, but she spoke French in my memory like a French person. And it was thanks to her that I decided to keep pursuing French studies in college, because she's like, look, you've come this far. You're excelling at this. Why give it up?
Mm.
And I think that I know she spent time in France. She never moved there, but she was instrumental in making me feel like this was not a dead end academic pursuit.
Right. That there was possibility beyond the frontier where you were.
Yeah. Although I didn't want to teach. And so I remember she said, you know, if you're going to take French studies in college, you really should take the AP exam. You're in an AP class. And I was like, yeah, okay. And I didn't. And yet I did continue pursuing. But I also thought, you know, I don't even know where the study of language is going to lead me. So I look at her as being sort of a guidepost, but not being the path. But that was enough for me.
Mm.
For other people, maybe they need more of sort of a mapped out way to do things. And I just figured, well, no one really has mapped out what I think I need. I don't know what I need, but I know that it's not going to be as an academic myself or an interpreter. So I don't really know, but this is something I'm good at. And I'm going to see where it leads. So I did go to France with her, actually, with her class in high school. It was like, you know, a spring break trip when all of my friends were, you know, with their families in some, you know, beachy destination. I was like, there's this opportunity. And my parents were like, why don't you do it? It would be good for you. Because I was also very much a kind of a homebody and very anxious. I used to have to get picked up from sleepovers because I'd have like a panic attack. Like separation anxiety, very strange. So it's very amusing to my family now as like the person who lives the furthest away from everybody.
That's amazing.
But, you know, so I think their idea was like, oh, you want to go to France on a spring break trip for like 10 days? Yes, go. This will be very good for you. You will grow up. And it was decisive in at least showing me that there's a beautiful world out there, obviously, and that maybe there's something intriguing here. And I don't want to stop studying French.
Mm.
So it wasn't like a mapped out route, but it was more illuminating than I think even my parents imagined it would be.
That's so interesting. I mean, there are two things that I think are fascinating about that story is that for you going, say, next door to someone's house for a sleepover was a source of anxiety for you. However, this much, much bigger investment of energy and distance somehow didn't trigger the same kind of anxiety and actually maybe was a little bit liberating for you.
It was. I mean, I will say that when I went back again between my junior and senior year, which is ultimately the moment where I realized this is where I was going to be, I arrived and I was staying in a foyer, you know, so like just for young student women or working like young professionals. And I remember thinking this is in the 13th arrondissement. It is, my room feels a bit like a prison cell. It has all brick walls. I feel a bit closed in. What did I just do? And I knew I was going to be there for 6 weeks. So I was like, I'm here day one and two and already like having those panic attack, like starting to have a panic attack that I remembered having as a kid. And I even called my parents on some like phone I rented because this was in 2006 and like no one had a cell phone that worked abroad. So I had to like rent a phone, which by the way, cost me, it was like hundreds and hundreds of euros by the end of that summer. Anyway, separate. We've really gotten at least a little bit, it's easier to leave now, I think for a whole host of reasons, including technology. But, And they were like, you just arrived, give it a minute. But my instinct was to say, I think I need to come home. And then the very next day, you know, sort of, I connected with some girls in the building, and then I met someone, a man, who I ended up marrying later, but I didn't know that.
You met him literally your second day?
Third day? Yep, third day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So it didn't take away the anxiety necessarily, but it showed me that I could, through him and through also the girls that I was meeting in my program who I was there studying with, we could explore. And this space wasn't going to crush me. I think it was also, you know, I didn't know the other girls yet. I came from a university that was not part of the program, the host program, and some of them knew each other. And so I, if I'm looking at a theme, it was, I was not necessarily comfortable with people I didn't know yet. And I felt alone. So as soon as I sort of got more comfortable with them, and then I was, you know, seeing Paris through the eyes of a local, I was like, oh, you know, so I think one of the themes in my life has been learning to sit with discomfort and not to freak out the second I feel really at odds with myself or like I need to break free. And I think being in an environment where building a social network and a life in a place where you don't know anybody forced me to become a lot more social and a lot more comfortable with social interaction than I ever was. And that maybe I would have, you know, than I would have been had I stayed in the US. So, you know, so I look at that time as being so instrumental for unlocking things in myself.
What do you think it was, what was the ingredient or the strength that was unlocked the most at that time?
A curiosity and the realization that there's like so many more important things going on elsewhere. That the fact that my big concern when I was 20 was, I'm going away for 6 weeks during the summer. I'm going to miss out on everything happening in the suburbs of Philadelphia. Like, what is wrong with you? But, you know, at that time, it felt so, oh, she's going abroad. I don't think people traveled the same way as they do now. You know, young people today, the number of like 18-year-olds I see traveling by themselves feels a lot. It feels like there's a lot more of them, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, than when I was, you know, coming over here. I mean, it's certainly cheaper, right? It's cheaper to travel. So we see more young people, but I just think it was like, it was me growing up.
Mm. Well, I think it's so fascinating. I keep coming back to this idea of, like, you said that your fear, there was fear included in being stuck in that, you know, center, which actually I think I was at too. I think that was at the same one, but I was only there for a couple of days before they put me into a host family. But I know what you're talking about. It was like
Tolbiac,
yes. And you're like, what are we doing here? It's teeny little rooms. There was like a big common set. I think there was like a big common area downstairs. We have to go back and visit it.
I can't believe that's, oh my gosh.
I know. That's so, I didn't know that.
I did not know
that's
that.
So, but I didn't have to stay very long, but I remember being like, what the hell is happening? But this notion of like, you've made the decision to come. There's something that is guiding you here. You have a glimmer of, okay, there's a part of me that I believe is going to be able to benefit from this growth and from this discomfort. And it's going to be part of the journey. And the way that you were able to get through it is to tap into the curiosity that you had for people and for the city and for just kind of understanding more of what's going on around you.
Absolutely. And I think also connecting with locals, which even if I hadn't met Cedric, I think I was meeting other French students and young professionals, like, it would have been through someone, because I already was like, I'm here to perfect my French as well. And some of the other Americans were like content to do everything amongst themselves. And that was never my objective. And so I kind of thought, well, either way, I'm going to sort of be bettering myself through this. Mm. And I do think it made all the difference.
Yeah.
You know, some of those girls have come back to visit. But none of them felt the same attachment to the culture, to the language as I did.
So there was something, there was like a homing system already in place that meant that you were going to go the long haul.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know how easy that would be. And obviously it proves not so simple. But again, I think that what worries me today is boredom. I like having moments of feeling bored because it's super important for my creative process and for just thinking and being well. But I remember at the time thinking like, well, I want to do this because it's a challenge. And I think that I might have been bored by whatever my routine would have been if I, you know, followed the same path as everyone I was in school with and got a job, went to a big city, or just whatever I did, it was going to be easier because obviously staying where you are is easier. In some ways. Okay. It's not always easy to make the choice to stay. But what I mean is, you know, it was not, as you know, as someone who lives here, you know, every little thing can be fraught with stress. I mean, there's like a challenge embedded into sometimes going to the post office. And so every little thing is slightly more challenging, which I think is enriching for me. That might not work for everyone. Mm.
But that's so cool to know about yourself, right?
Which I discovered because I didn't, you know, I thought this is so big. How could I navigate this without guidance from someone else?
Right. And so you realized that you were able to find that guidance through tapping into others and your own curiosity. And what I love about that is when you say something about boredom, it's almost like we become used to relying on distraction to overcome our boredom. And leaning into the difficulty of not knowing and being challenged on a regular basis is, I think it's something it's a real skill that is something that we don't really realize that we've developed when you've made so many decisions that have put you out of your comfort zone, that it makes it a lot easier for you to continue to push the envelope because you're used to not ever really being in the, you know, in the neutral steady zone.
Yeah, I actually think boredom is less the correct word. It's comfort. Mm. It's, you know, people who don't like to leave their little, you know, neighborhood or way of doing things, there's a comfort there and that feels safe. And I definitely had that safety feeling. But there was clearly something else going on internally that made me feel like I could take a chance and it would either be great for me or I would learn that it isn't ultimately for me, but there was the ability to at least test it out. Mm,
I love that. So I want to talk a little bit about this idea of, you know, the discomfort, the walking the line between discomfort and comfort, especially when you're not living in your native country or speaking your native tongue. And when I think about the work that you do, I consider you to be someone who is incredible at channeling your frustrations in a creative way. Like, you don't just sit with your observations of the world around you and say, this is messed up. Okay, there's nothing I could do about it. You channel your frustrations into some kind of creative project. The biggest ones are your books, where you basically are just like, wait, what everyone thinks is going on in this city is incorrect. There are parts of the story that are inaccurate. It's not inclusive. And I'm going to dig in and actually correct the narrative on what my adopted city is really about. So I want to kind of peel back the onion on that a bit, because there must have been some kind of inkling of that way of interpreting reality that predates being in Paris. And so when did you first learn to channel your frustrations into some kind of creative output?
I always enjoyed writing. I wrote poems, like pretty angsty, like grim adolescent style poetry. But like, there was this idea that whatever I was going through, and it was usually a lot of like heartbreak with the boy of the moment, or, you know, And I listened to a lot of music that was very emotional. And so, you know, you listen to Fiona Apple and Tori Amos enough and it starts to influence how you put down words, I think. But none of that seemed like, I didn't consider myself a super creative person. I didn't understand what creative could mean. That's another thing I think is a sort of shortcoming of education in not just America, but in a lot of places, is that you can be creative and not go to art school. You can be creative and not become an actor or a musician. And it's not very clear what to do with these sort of skills in you. And I don't think anybody really harnessed that in me, which is why I didn't know that I could, you know, make a viable living involving writing until I kind of created it for myself once in Paris. But I think I was always an emotional kid. I was, you know, I felt things really deeply, and I'm a very sensitive person. And so everything would sort of get to me in a way, but I wasn't incensed. Like, I wasn't outraged by political things. I think actually there was a distance, and I will say that social media and the internet, obviously, which has only grown more prominent as I became, as I entered sort of my 20s, you know, I didn't have access to the steady stream of news and hardships going on in the world. But as soon as I did have access to that, then the outrage and the frustration and the hurt related to those things came out. Before, it was sort of circumstantial or environmental things in my little unit. But then it became much bigger. And so I think it was just, I don't know what else to do with these feelings except talk about them. Except once I started, you know, when I was in Paris and I was trying to figure out where I was going after grad school and, you know, am I going to get a job? Like, what am I going to be doing here? I started a blog because that's what you did at the time. People had blogs. And I think that's where the comfort in writing in a way that wasn't just for me developed. But surely, as you say, you know, there are these inklings or stirrings of these kinds of things when you're young. And I think it was just a journal with some really emotional, angsty poetry and short stories, maybe. And then, but no one saw them. I don't even know where they are. I'm sure someone has collected notebooks from when my mom sold the house and are maybe terrified by what they saw. But all that to say, like, it was a private matter. It was a private endeavor. And that was the evolution, that it became less private because I realized maybe I could connect with people.
So is this kind of heightened sensitivity to your feelings, that feeling really is like a very strong feeler of feelings that you channeled in your, you know, world, your creative world that was not meant for anyone to see, your poems, your journals. But then little by little, it became a way for you to externalize that, and through externalizing it, connect with other people who are maybe feeling similar things.
Absolutely. And, you know, it takes time to, you know, get a readership. And some people never do. But from the first couple of comments on that early blog, realizing that, you know, there were people out there who were going to read and who were identifying with something, even if it was just a commentary on the city, like there were people who were reacting. And that made me feel like there is something here. But again, none of it felt like it could be professional in any way. And I still thought, you know, this was happening after I graduated, with a master's, and thinking like, oh, the economy has crashed. I'm just lost, really. And, you know, it's not like the blog helped me figure out what I was going to do professionally, but it did give me a creative outlet as I tried to figure out what the future was going to look like.
I think that's so, you know, a lot of people want to know with certainty what to do with their professional path. You know, people come to me all the time, and the biggest ask is, I want to make a change. I just don't know what that is, but I want to know with certainty that it's going to work out. And I can't help but laugh, because there's a conundrum there, you can't know with certainty what the thing is going to be for you over the long term without starting somewhere. You gotta put some skin in the game. You gotta feel your way through it and see whether or not you like it. Are you good at it? Does it bring you joy? Does it bring you satisfaction? And so what I'm hearing with what you're saying is like you started this blog and you realize that there's stuff there. There's stuff there to continue to kind of unravel and work on and develop, but you don't really know what it's going to lead to.
No, certainty was definitely not a word I would use to describe anything I've done once I left school, basically. Once sort of the structure and sort of very written through process of going through school ends, then I'm on my own. So there was a lot of, I definitely had some panic attacks again when I was trying to find a job here. And also not really feeling drawn to, you know, the options, which were marketing and advertising. And, you know, it just felt like, okay, well, that's, you know, I studied communication, so that's one application. But again, it was the period of 2008, 2009, serious, like world economic turmoil. There were not the same professional options as there had been even 2 years prior. And so I had to get comfortable really quickly in all of the discomfort and anxiety, and it was really hard. I definitely had a lot of, I think my husband, we had gotten married by that point, but my husband, who had a much more stable job, you know, sort of didn't understand why this was so troubling to me. You know, already I was just like, well, I need to make money. I need to get on my feet. I need to know what I'm doing here, how I'm contributing. And I think that if there's anything I learned out of that really horrible experience is that, first of all, those roadblocks and those moments of like actual strife do shape you. And it helped me really accept, like fully accept, that things do play out in a way that they're either meant to, or in a way that will bring you clarity at some point. It's just you have to hold on and keep some level of faith that it will do that. It will lead you. But even now, you know, I've been and I know this is something we'll probably get to, but I've been trying to work on a third book project, and it's a harder sell this time. And it's a project that is a bit of a departure for me. And I've been back to the drawing board for a year, retooling the proposal. And, you know, one side of my brain is like, should you give up? Maybe this is just not meant to be. And maybe that will still be true. But for now, I thought, no, it just needs more time. And it's okay. Not everything can happen quickly. And I think that's sort of, I'm more zen about that situation or that state of this project, because I went through all those other hurdles for years and years, realizing that sometimes my personal path or whatever just takes time, and I have to be confident that it will lead somewhere.
I mean, it's so, thank you for sharing that, because I think that especially when we're part of a culture that is very much prone to celebrate the ribbon cuttings and success and the award ceremony. And we don't think about all of those moments of doubt and panic and stress and really feeling, am I in the right place? Is this the project? Is this what I should be focusing on? Maybe I should just like go on to LinkedIn and take that corporate job. I don't know if that ever happened to you, but that's happened to me. But these moments where you're like, maybe I should just give it all up. And so I think it's real. That's why I want this space to be about sharing those moments, because they're not easy to navigate. And it's, where do you go? How do you tap into the self-trust and the self-security when you're not getting the signals around you that what you're trying to defend is the best bet?
Well, that's where you really need a good network of friends, and friends that you share things with in a really honest way. And I do have that with a group of women who are also not necessarily creative in the same ways, although some of them are, who either lend sort of, I don't want to say tough love in a really negative way, but you know, sort of who are able to play devil's advocate in a knowing that I'll hear what they have to say, and others who just have thought of something that I missed, or who say, you know, it took me X amount of time to reach this, and by the time I did, it was actually better because you had matured the idea, you had really spent the mental energy thinking about it in a deeper way, and you're not just rushing to get something out the door or on the table or whatever, you know, get something out there. And then the other thing is, I think of, well, there are two things. One, someone once told me that, well, comparison is toxic. We know that. So that's another thing I'm like, have to like actively remind myself of, that it's of no use to really compare myself to anyone else doing what I'm doing, because everyone has a different process. They have different connections. They have different ways of working. And so it's not super productive for me to go down that road. Mm. And then the second thing is, I think of like more recently of actors who, you know, had disappeared for 10 years and then come back and come out with something quite unbelievable, like Brendan Fraser, who just won an Oscar, who had literally vanished from screens. And I think there's, as you say, we talk more about the rip and cutting successes, the inaugural big moments, but actually, we should be remembering that in certain crafts, it takes time. And, you know, I try to remind myself also of these authors who are like, you know, their bestseller came when they were 80. Like, it's a long game. And I think I have to actively fight against the belief that things need to happen quickly.
Yeah, that kind of brings us back to that discomfort, the boredom discomfort theme of being able to sit with the time that it takes. And also, it's so interesting you say, like, there are actors who have disappeared, but while they're disappeared, no one's saying, where are they? It's usually when they reappear, you're like, wow, that was an unbelievable performance. And thank you for gifting us with that. There's this belief that everyone is kind of waiting for the next delivery. And if there's any delay or there's a gap, that it's going to, you know, put up a lot of red flags, where people are really just kind of in their own little world.
Absolutely.
And when you birth whatever you birth, it's, you know, it's the time that it takes and it's the reception that it gets. But there's often this thing like, what are people going to say? Because it's taking me this amount of time to do the thing.
And, you know, I think that the fact that my own career took so much time to unfurl and for me to figure out what it was going to look like in a way that was right for me, clearly that involved leaving the corporate world. You know, so I was freelance writing while I was also in a company, and then eventually made the switch, which is ultimately right for me. But, you know, the only reason I'm comfortable or more comfortable, that doesn't mean it's not hard, but more comfortable with the idea that this project, if it happens, it just needed more time, is because I had to get used to that. And I do think that the more you sort of go through this realization, the easier it becomes to identify as it's happening. But it's very hard when you also, you know, it's so easy to pay attention to social media in a way where you believe that everyone's accolades or projects are coming at the snap of the fingers, and that you're not seeing the work behind it. And maybe you're not also seeing that some of these people really do have so many connections that things move faster, and that's just out of everyone's control. But, you know, taking the time away from those influences and those potential stressors or additional sources of anxiety are important. You know, leave the platform. If you start to spiral because you're, you know, you can feel yourself going down this mental road of, you know, why them? Why not me? That's a really bad place to be. Get off that train for a while.
Yeah. So that's a sign. That's an indicator of those are the thoughts that you're having.
Yeah. And we all have them. I mean, and I know that's usually my sign that I've been scrolling too long and I need to get off and go back to normal life because that's not normal life.
Right. The famous doom scrolling.
And I'm a lot better than I was during COVID, where it was like, I think Cedric thought I was going to, I don't know, just become like an activist who stops working and just goes in the streets and yells at everybody for everything. I don't know, but it was not a good place.
So one of the things that you say in your book, The New Parisienne, which is just such a fascinating level of deepening your understanding of this culture and this country that you've adopted and that's adopted you. Because it really is, you go into a lot, you shine the light in lots of uncomfortable places, and really bring up the question of like, what is the Parisian identity really consist of? And one thing that you say, and I'll quote, it says, "What I have found inspiring and nourishing is to learn how other women channel their pain and frustrations into greatness, their own personal greatness, whatever that may be." And we've touched upon this. I want to know, how does that statement mirror your own experience? And what previously perceived weaknesses have become, and this is a term borrowed by Michelle Obama, the source code for your greatness? What are those, maybe those little nuggets that you were uncomfortable accepting in yourself that now you realize are actually the source of your strength and what makes you unique?
I think that sensitivity that we talked about earlier, that often can feel so overwhelming and uncontrollable that it could only be a negative, but actually I'm just deeply empathetic. And so these women that I was meeting and hearing their stories, and it happened even before I was actually working on the book. I was meeting people all the time and hearing stories and, you know, seeing what they've done with their lives and their careers, having come off of, you know, incredible strife, whether that's within their home countries, whether that's within their families, whatever. And I think it makes me, it sort of like feeds my empathy pool. And realizing that you do not need to sort of wither in this pain or hurt, that there are other ways of applying that. And so for some women that I spoke with, it was, you know, one who grew up within the war in Lebanon and her house was bombed, and, you know, realizing that there was, the only thing she could do to sort of get through was she read books and she started to see the beauty in destruction and in imperfect landscapes and urban environments. And she became an architect and has a very distinct point of view on aesthetics and beauty and, you know, navigating that line between beautiful and imperfect, or perfect and imperfect. And I thought that was powerful. She was one of the catalysts for my book when I met her. I just felt like, you're here, you're doing this business, you're creating in a world that's already not super open to women, architecture, and you're doing it in this way, having experienced such trauma. And I just thought it was incredible. So listening to these stories and realizing that it's a it can be a choice how you apply what your lived experience into your career, into your future. And I know people who have let it really get to them and their whole identity has become their trauma, their pain, they're the victim of their whole lives. And I know people in my own family that way. And I don't think that's not the way I can do it. That's not the way I want to do it.
The way you talk about your sensitivity, your super sensitivity and your empathy being in a way your source code, I'm reading your output in a very different way, even when you talk about how awkward it was for Macron to be having his arms around Kylian Mbappé when he lost the seconds after he lost, you know, the World Cup. Now I'm seeing, like, I feel that your ability to tap into what you perceive as a very sensitive moment for someone else allows you to kind of like spring forward different ways of interpreting what that might have been like for that person. And in that note, it's a raw moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's a raw moment. It's a raw moment. And I don't know, I think I've always been just very observant and able to pick up on people's body language and their you know, the sort of discreet signs. And that moment was so uncomfortable for me to watch, because I was just like, this is not what they need right now. And you are not respecting what they need in this moment. Right. There's something very disappointing, maybe even traumatic for some of them, because, you know, this is a publicized loss. Everyone in the world, you know, potentially can see this. And then here he is swooping in to sort of like in an opportunistic way. At least that's the way I interpreted it. And, you know, there are people who will say, oh, he's just, you know, he's got this like really deep obsession with football, and sort of he forgets who he is and where he is. And like, okay, fine. Maybe that is there. Maybe there's an element of truth to that. But there's still this idea that he, in my opinion, was not respectful of their feelings.
Yeah.
And I just know how I would feel in that moment. Now, does that mean I need to share this with the entire world? No, but I do think that there was something there, and I'm not the only one who picked up on it. So I think there are people who are like hugely empathetic individuals observing this moment and thinking like, maybe this should have been handled differently.
Well, I mean, I have to say, when that happened, and I, you know, there was a debate in my home about it, because I read it, and I think it's probably from like a deep desire for more paternal presence, that there was a read like, oh, he's being so supportive and kind, and he's picking up on their pain. And my husband was like, that's just weird. Like, that's not his role as the president, to be comforting professional athletes. And so what I want to say is, typically when there's a moment like that, my instinct is to go and see what you have to say about it.
Wow. It's true. You did send me a message, actually. And I think I hadn't yet done an episode on the issue. And then I was like, oh no, she's motivated me. Now I have to have someone on to talk about this. Because
right. Yeah. When I'm in some kind of dilemma about how I feel about something that's related to contemporary French culture, I always know that you are going to put a lens on the issue from many different perspectives, but it's a deeply feeling perspective. And it allows me to kind of question my initial thoughts or instincts or beliefs.
I mean, I never realized that's a role I could play or have, but I do appreciate it. And I, you know, there are things that I don't comment on because I don't feel like I have anything of value to add or an informed enough opinion. But, you know, obviously with the pension reforms that have been going on, you know, I have felt very passionate about it and, you know, have engaged in conversations that have led to some very civil and illuminating debates. And, you know, and then you brush off the people who are just like, you know, your opinion is ridiculous. Like, you know, whatever they're saying. But I try to be very judicious about it, and I'm not trying to you know, think that I my opinion is somehow worth gold and that everyone needs to be subjected to it. But the people who do, I guess, feel like I have some sort of a lens to offer on this place, you know, especially since I do most of the time write on my platforms in English, it's a way for potentially another, for people who love France, who are living elsewhere, to have their ideas challenged a bit. maybe it won't sway them entirely, and that's fine. I'm not here to like indoctrinate anybody, but even my own father, you know, who had his own interpretations on pension reform, listened to the like 7-minute podcast I did just trying to add additional context, because sometimes people aren't going to take the time to read all the New York Times analysis and, you know, wherever they're reporting this, but they might listen to something and it might be the way to get them to think think or perceive another angle on an issue. And so he told me actually that it did sway him a bit. And, you know, he still doesn't know, you know, financially how any country is going to be able to fund everyone's pensions, but at least he has a better appreciation for why people are so upset.
Yeah.
And so that to me feels like a success. It means that, you know, you're not just sitting with what you believed you knew.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you are able to push the needle on belief systems that seem pretty rigid, I think, by presenting other perspectives and not necessarily trying to indoctrinate by that through that sharing, but just educate and open people's minds.
Yeah, I think it's just, I have this, I think with empathy comes connection, as we talked about. And also, and I'm not saying education is the right word either, but I like this idea of information flow that is maybe less, you know, I'm not attached to any one newspaper or magazine staff. I have a little bit more liberty in the opinions I'm allowed to share. So, you know, I think a lot of people who follow journalists online, sometimes, you know, will say, you're at the New York Times, why aren't you taking a stand against X, Y, and Z? And technically they're not supposed to, right? And so I think that I realize that I'm someone who would have a lot of trouble keeping quiet if there's something I really feel strongly about. And that is not at all a role that I had imagined for myself ever. I think I kind of fell into it. And I think I kind of, through podcasting or through all the interviews I do for work, realizing how much I feel fulfilled by conversation and sort of the exchange of ideas.
Mm.
But again, like that's something when I speak with my dad, he's like, you know, you've really, I think that going abroad and having to do this on your own and build something forced you to develop these skills that you may not have harnessed or developed before. And he sees it as such a positive thing. And I'm, you know, I'm always, it always gets me thinking when he says things like that, because I try to remember like, or I try to imagine what I would be doing. What else would I be doing? And I honestly, I mean, it's kind of a futile exercise because you really just don't know. But I just really had no idea that anything I was doing would lead me to what I'm doing now.
Well, and yet it feels so natural when you observe it from the outside.
Sure. I mean, I guess so. But, you know, I think that's also because I become so much more, and people ask me like, do you get nervous when you do interviews or when someone asks you questions? And I'm like, no, in the beginning, yes. But like, it's a muscle like anything else. And so I don't feel petrified. My heart rate is not elevated right now. My heart rate was elevated when I was in a car with a driving examiner who was going to maybe pass or fail me for a driving, you know, for my driver's license. That's a very different
right interaction. Right. So this is you've neutralized.
And I'm sure if I did that a million times, yeah, this is me mm-hmm. feeling at ease.
And so that notion of what are you leaning into now? The voice that you've cultivated, the empathy that you have, the sensitivity. You say in your book that there's nothing more dangerous and primally terrifying to the established order than a woman with a voice. And that quote gives me chills up and down my body. And I 100% adhere to that. And so for you, when do you believe that was a crystallized truth for you? When did you figure that out? And what terror do you want to unleash with your voice?
I think it was really during some of the anti-racist protests. Even the ones in France in 2020, and discussing with women like Roca Yadillo, who's one of the women in my book, but others who were like super vocal during this time and reacting to sort of the state's attempt to squash or quiet some of the unrest. And similarly during Me Too, which, you know, is sort of like the ever fluctuating conversation. It came out with a bang. It fades a bit. It comes back. But realizing actually when I trace this feeling of realizing the threat women are to the established order is really their ability to speak up and actually get other people on board, was during this time. So starting with Me Too and then, you know, through COVID and realizing that, you know, if you're able to rally people together around an idea or around a perceived injustice, you have a lot of power. Because you know, look at how the French Revolution happened, right? It's a lot of people who feel a very specific way and can connect with other people over that. And in this case, you know, if we're thinking about, you know, rights for women or gay rights or anti-racist sort of justice that you know that the country has maybe been lacking on, you realize that there are people who are going to speak out and you're going to learn from them. And if you compare that to the way states in the US are trying to control what children read and removing books from bookshelves and from schools and trying to reframe historical events so that they are not offensive to people, including white people, you know, that's a sign that they are threatened by informed people. And there's a lot of power when you hold the knowledge. Mm. And if you're the only one, you're in a government, you're a leader, and you're the only one with the knowledge, and then people will sort of blindly believe you. But as soon as they start learning from other people, you know, the narrative and perspective shifts. And so I think that's ultimately why we have these, you know, ongoing tensions is because, especially for patriarchal systems, and that, you know, women are also part of that and embedded in that, whether they realize it or not. And this willingness to sort of not give people the rights they deserve is a way of wielding the control. And so shutting women up in particular is a way of, you know, trying to say, keep on the accusation of, you know, hysterical women, you know, all the things we used to say to women that were, you know, completely unfounded, but all of that is a power move. So yeah, so I think I realized it during this period. And now every time we are confronted with a situation, that's what I see happening. Or sort of that's how I interpret what's happening. Not everything relates to women being silenced, but when it is involving, you know, sort of men, for example, being very uncomfortable with the idea of giving women more rights to live freely and be in this world on an equal playing field. I mean, to me, that's what it is. It's they are afraid mm-hmm. of losing power. So how do I relate to that? I mean, I just try not to, like I said, I'm still very specific on what I will comment on, but you know, when I feel like I have to, I will. And also I think with the book, it's like, you know, we also need to tell the stories of people who, some of whom can't tell them themselves or can't break through to tell them or have the audience to tell them. Mm. They have to get out there somewhere.
So there's a combination of the realization that you have that platform, you have the ability to fédérer, to bring together people.
Or isolate people potentially, but you know, I try not to. But no, I'm sure I've, you know, like I'm at various points. I know, for example, when Biden won the election, and I, you know, I said something about, you know, the milestone for a lot of women that is Kamala Harris's seat as vice president, and you know, I had lots of like, you know, a lot of, you know, either supposedly non-political or just right-wing commentary from people. It's like, you haven't been paying, you know, like we're not here following you for this stuff. It's like, actually, if you've been paying attention, this isn't like some abnormal stance for me. It's just that you're, you know, either you're not paying attention or you've chosen to ignore other commentary, but you're also invited to leave if you don't, you know, if you don't like it. It's true that it's not always, you know, it's not always a place of civil conversation, but I'm not, you know, as long as I show some food too, I think people are okay.
Right. They're like, just bring me the pizza. Where's the pizza?
But I will say that there are enough people who follow me for many things and are almost, I don't know, like more engaged when I come out with something that opens up discussion on more serious issues. So I think that's the thing. I don't ever want to be one thing. And, you know, generalists, especially in writing or in journalism, do have a certain flexibility, I guess, in that way. But I don't know. I just wouldn't want to feel limited.
Mm-hmm. Well, that comes across. I mean, that comes across in the way that I read it, and I almost feel like there's that part of you is growing and almost like unrelentless. And so with that in mind, I mean, because you mentioned in the preface to the New Parisienne that it was an idea that was kind of came in the wake of the New Paris. So what has come in the wake of the New Parisienne in terms of, you alluded to another project, to the best of your ability to share certain details with us, what can you give us an idea of what this project is about, or what is the subject that you are interested in sinking your teeth into over a period of time?
Well, it relates to some of the questions you've asked today, but not just for me, but, you know, for other people as well, sort of this idea of leaving and what are some of the reasons we leave. I mean, I can't say much more than that, but all that to say that, you know, my story still connects to France, but hopefully this would incorporate the stories and thoughts of people who have left for other places. And so trying to broaden my scope beyond France, because obviously, you know, as individuals who have built a life outside of our home in other countries, we have a sort of shared experience with other people, whether they're in France or not. And trying to sort of dig a bit deeper into that particular aspect of the life abroad experience.
Mm. Is there a term? What would be the term that you use for someone who has lived abroad for a long time?
An immigrant.
An immigrant.
Or as you said, a self-exile. I mean, look, if you're someone, I mean, I talk about this and, you know, the media seems to never want to do the due diligence on the use of this word. But when people say expat, you know, it's kind of thrown around as like, you know, someone from a privileged nation going to another nation. But really it pertains to people who go for a specific amount of time. So someone who's like sent by their company and they're on a 3-year, 5-year contract, technically they are expats at the end, the assumption is that they go home. If they end up staying and, you know, going through all the bureaucratic hoops to stay, then they become immigrants. But I've always thought of myself as an immigrant. And once I understood that distinction, immediately stopped using the word expat. So I don't see myself as an expat. Maybe exile, but that's a bit intense, I think, for my particular situation. Mm-hmm. But I do think we need to be a little bit more specific with those words, because And if someone views themselves less as an immigrant, I mean, I don't know what to tell them other than like maybe they need to look at the dictionary. But and like, it's not just a term used for people of color who leave their homelands. Like, truly, you and I are immigrants, and mm-hmm. that's fine. And actually, we become citizens, and so therefore, we're technically not immigrants anymore. But whatever, we came as immigrants, mm-hmm. Trying to normalize the use of these words so that they're not sort of like attached with this othering mm-hmm. that seems unnecessary.
For sure. I mean, and there's, it's very, this is a whole separate conversation. But I think that for me, also, the theme of the podcast and this desire to know more about how we become who we become has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, my family were immigrants from Russia and Eastern Europe and Greece. And I think for me coming to France, there was a search for something, some kind of something unknown in my story. And I even wound up figuring out not that long ago that my great grandmother, who had to flee Russia in the early part of the 20th century, that she passed through Paris on her way to America.
I mean, that's fascinating.
Fascinating. And I've always been like, there must be someone in my family who's like walked the streets of Paris. How is it possible that I'm so connected to this city, to this country? And learning about that was almost as if I was given a little bit of a little clue. But I feel very connected to this desire to know more about, you know, what does it mean when you decide to go somewhere else, for what reason, and what does it do to you?
Yeah, and how transformative it can be, because obviously it changed my life. And I know people who stay for a time and realize it's not for them, but they still return somewhere changed in some way. And I think that can only make us more interesting and rich people.
So we're at the end of our conversation here, which I've adored. And I want to know, based on all the different places we've gone, what has there been anything that you've discovered about yourself that maybe was not as clear to you prior to the beginning of our conversation, something that you've discovered about the person you're becoming?
I guess, you know, I have this idea, I have this feeling that I'm not that my words don't matter, but that, you know, surely I'm not going to reach the people that other writers or other thinkers could reach. And that, you know, clearly I'm just like this minute speck, and that's fine if that's true. But hearing the way you sort of spoke about when you turn to me or when you turn to what I write, and then some messages I get on like fairly regularly, not constant obviously, but from individuals who have been touched in some way by either a story, an element of my own story, an idea, it makes me just feel like purpose is really not about becoming a best-selling whatever. And I have this discussion with a lot of friends who are creative, who have built brands and built products or built things, about when they'll actually feel fulfilled and what success really means for them. And it's not always growth in number. It's not huge scale endeavors necessarily. And I think that realizing that to live a full life, you can still hold the control and not have to, you know, have a whole team of people involved. You know, it's not like I have someone answering emails for me. It's me. Like that, I don't know. I sometimes have to keep myself in check. Like, you know, even the Roxane Gays and Danny Shapiros of the world, who are tremendous thinkers and writers, like probably just went with the flow and are living their craft in the way that they know best. And for me, it looks like this at this time, and that there's that really enjoying the process is part of the experience, and I can't just focus on the output.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think that it's going to inspire a lot of people who look to you as a guidepost and as a model of what being successful as a multicultural journalist and expert on an adopted land looks like. And so being able to be transparent about that, I think it's incredibly empowering and liberating. So thank you so much for that, Lindsay, and for your time.
Thank you for asking such good questions.
You're welcome, darling.
So thoughtful, so well articulated. I don't know. This show's going to be big for you.
Oh. Well, thank you for saying yes so enthusiastically.
Of course.
On this inaugural season. So, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Hey there. Thanks for listening all the way to the end of this episode. I just wanted to close the loop with you. So on April 17th, almost a month after Lindsay and I recorded the conversation you just listened to, she published a story in New York Magazine titled, "Living Abroad Helped Me Cope with My Tourette Syndrome." The article is the first time Lindsay has opened up publicly about her neurodevelopmental disorder. In the piece, she speaks specifically about how France's slower pace of life and healthcare system has allowed her to understand and manage her condition in a way that she wouldn't be able to do had she stayed in the United States. It's a fascinating read that provides more context and color to the conversation we had together, especially when we talked about her sensitivity being a superpower in detecting other people's distress, and maybe where her mission to create a more inclusive portrait of La Parisienne comes from. I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.